Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. There's that old saying, you can never be too rich or too thin. Well, now in France, being too thin could be an obstacle to becoming too rich. French lawmakers are trying to ban underweight women from modeling. And in Southern California, a ban engineered to prevent people from getting too fat has backfired. Joining us on the line to talk about the latest news where health and ethics intersect is Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the terrific Everyday Ethics podcast. Hey there, Art.
Hey, how are you?
Hey. Excellent.
By the way, I already know the answer to this regulate body size.
What's it?
All the people who are models in France must move to Southern California and vice versa.
We'll get to that in a second.
Yeah,
we'll get to that in a second.
I wanted to start today with Angelina Jolie, who's written yet another op-ed piece in the New York Times. As people know, she had a double mastectomy because she was worried about a family history of breast cancer, and she had the genetic markings to put her in very likely to get breast cancer. Now she's written a second one talking about how she had surgery to remove her ovaries and fallopian tubes to reduce her cancer risk. What's the takeaway? What's the impact of her being so honest about her own situation, Art Kaplan?
Well, I think there's a lot of good. She's drawing attention to the fact that there are women out there at high risk of hereditary, meaning passed through your biological relatives, breast and ovarian cancer. So if you've got a pattern of that in your family, you probably want to go out and get a genetic test, not from one of the commercial companies that ask you to do it online, but from a real human genetics center at a hospital or academic medical center. And I think drawing attention to that risk factor is important, and I commend her for it. Downside of what she's doing, not everybody with breast cancer has breast cancer because of what she has. There are plenty of people who get it for other reasons that aren't genetic, and you don't want to mix up the two. Removing toxins and having a better diet and not smoking are keys to diminish risk for most people. That won't work for her because she's got such a strong genetic mutation problem, but it would for others. It would help. So, you know, you don't have to think, gosh, if I am at risk of breast cancer because my doctor said, you know, I'm in a healthy lifestyle thing. The thing to do is get rid of that lifestyle, not worry too much about these horrendous surgeries, and they are horrendous. Other things, you know, it's great that she writes for the New York Times and draws attention to the thing. She is really writing, and I'm going to say this, for the 1%. And what I mean by that is Angelina Jolie can go anywhere and get opinions from anybody.
Yep.
There's no financial hurdles for her. So the average person who maybe doesn't have such great health insurance, they may not even get coverage for genetic testing. There are situations where people won't be able to identify the fact that they're in a risk group because they don't go to the primary care doctor because it's too expensive and so on. And even with all the health insurance reform that we've seen, there's still plenty of folks out there who are vulnerable. So that, I think, is a problem. It's, you know, we're kind of looking at one of the most empowered women you could think of to go out and ask every expert and fly everywhere and call everybody. That's not the average person. Last gripe, one of the things she mentioned in her column was that she talked to her naturopath. She explored alternative medicine.
Yep.
I think it's all nonsense. And if you're in a high-risk group for cancer, you don't want to be doing that. And my evidence for that listeners will remember, is Steve Jobs.
I was just going to say, Steve Jobs, exactly the same deal. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Art.
So Steve Jobs, remember, he delayed and went down the alternative medicine path for his pancreatic cancer, and then ultimately got a transplant of a liver because his cancer had spread, but he died shortly thereafter. If he had gone to mainstream medicine, most people think he probably could have been saved.
Yeah.
You know, Art, so I'm reading between the lines of what you're saying, because as you know, for the most part, Angelina Jolie, for at least the first editorial, and this one's fairly recent, has gotten rave reviews throughout the land. Is this a net plus, her story, or is it not?
It's a net plus. Net plus, it gets people talking about an important health issue. Gets them, if they have doctors to ask, they can ask the doctors, am I in this kind of a risk group? Would prophylactic removal of my breasts or ovaries help me? So those are, you know, I don't want to be having to ask those questions, but they're questions that need to get asked. She's brave. She did it. You know, one other teeny issue is why they didn't take her ovaries out when she had the breast surgery. You know, why the two stages? One of the reasons could be when you have your ovaries out, you go into menopause. Maybe she didn't want to. I was thinking maybe she wanted to try and have another baby. I don't know. But it is a little, it's a little unusual. Most people at her age would have everything done.
Well, you know, Art Kaplan, two things. I think the one thing that is great about Angelina Jolie, well, there are several things, but the big one of the big things is to me is she is an international sex symbol, a symbol of beauty. And she keeps talking about how she still feels feminine. She has no breasts. She has no ovaries. She has no fallopian tubes. The things that make you a woman are pretty much gone from her. And she still talks about feeling feminine. I think that's a very important message because obviously for a lot of women, when you lose your breasts, you don't, you know what I mean?
I think that's a great point. You know, she's not worrying about loss of femininity.
Yeah.
She's speaking out about how she feels, you know, feminine, and she's an actress and clearly a very pretty woman and all this sort of thing. So you're right. I think that is a good message also that, you can be a sexual being, you can be an object of beauty, even when you have some of these secondary sexual characteristics gone.
Yeah. And the second thing is, I wondered, and maybe it's because she's too wealthy and rich, so it won't be relevant either, but she's 39. She's going to go into menopause early, which is what most women don't go through until their 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if there's anything that she could do to kind of rethink menopause with all her exploring, or is it just that that's irrelevant because she's so loaded she could get all these extra treatments that the regular woman can't?
Normally when people go into menopause, one of the things they do is they get those hormone replacements.
Yeah.
I don't think they'd fool with those in an at-risk cancer patient.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say she'll just go through that. Maybe she'll see her alternative medicine person for something. But I don't think mainstream medicine has a lot to offer even to somebody who's rich and capable of accessing all resources.
Okay.
We're talking to Art Kaplan, medical ethicist from NYU. Art, now we're going to try to make the South LA-Paris connection, if we can. Let's start in California. There was this ordinance that essentially banned fast food joints from South LA, where the obesity or rate, or those who are overweight or obese, was 63%. The thinking being, the positive thinking being, well, let's get rid of the what is believed to be the source of a lot of this obesity, namely
crap. And then this ban was overturned when Ronald and the King threatened to form a gang, or what?
And 4 years later, I mean, and the controversial part of this, beyond the whole concept, was it is essentially targeting one piece of the population, poor people and mostly people of color. Well, 4 years later, the obesity and overweight rate was 63%. 4 years later, it goes to 75%. What's the ethical moral of this story?
If you're not going to really get into watching advertising, bringing back recess, having more athletic activities in school, trying to get the kids out from mandatory homework in elementary school every night, let them run around outside a bit, if you're going to helicopter parent them so they never cross the threshold, I think we kind of know where obesity comes from. It's mass quantities of food advertised all the time. It's sort of sluggish lifestyles. People like to point at genes, to come back to Angelina Jolie, but I'm not going there. I think it's cultural. So, tough fight. Got a lot of food in this country. Got a lot of computers in this country. Got a lot of video games in this country. Got a lot of nervous parents who don't want their kids go outside at all anywhere. That's a bad combo.
How do you feel about this targeting, though? You don't know me well enough to know, but Marjorie does. If I could ban all fast food restaurants across the country,
Jim's a big
I'd sign on
banner.
but targeting one piece of the population, I assume it was well intentioned. I don't know, but what's your take on that?
Well, the minorities do have a bigger problem with obesity in kids. I think that is a fact. So it's not a hugely bigger problem. I mean, there are plenty of people in the burbs who have the same issues with kids as well. You know, but here's my point. So you're telling me about this. This morning I just read the NCAA just signed a deal with Burger King. Burger King is now the official sponsor of NCAA sports, the big NCAA sports, probably football and basketball. Who plays those?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the messages will be loud and clear in all the commercials that the kids are watching.
Should we cross the ocean then?
Well, let's talk about, speaking of crossing the ocean, Jim said in the introduction about lawmakers in France trying to ban underweight women from becoming models. Now, obviously, this is not likely to happen in the United States. I don't know how far the French are going to get with it either. But does this send any kind of good message, or should we even care about this?
I like it. I think it sends a message. So, I don't know if they're going to be able to enforce it. It's kind of hard to just tell somebody they can't work. But, you know, we have requirements for job safety. Maybe ultra-thinness, anorexia is a threat to the worker. I don't know. It'll be tricky. I don't think you could enforce it here either. But the message is good. It sort of says, you know, we want to move away from that. That's not the right ideal. Let's have a little bit more normal-sized people modeling clothes. So I like it. I think it's a good message. And coming from the center, one of the centers anyway, the fashion industry, France and Paris, that's going to get hurt a little bit.
Yeah, I want to go back to South LA for 1 second to defend myself so we don't get all this angry email about my banning predilection. I hope I get this right. Marjorie, correct me if I'm wrong, and you may even know about this, Art, but we talked about it on the show about a year or two ago. The guy in California who owned a fast food joint, which was the first drive-through fast food joint, I think, in the world, at least the United States, ended it about a year or two ago in California, got rid of the drive-through, because the notion was, if you're going to eat all this horrible crap, at least get out of your car and walk into the restaurant, as opposed to... Now, that's not a horrible idea, is it?
No, it probably sends a message, too, that's a little bit worth hearing. I mean, you know, what are we going to say about fast food? These are huge businesses. I know McDonald's, they're in trouble. Their sales have been falling.
Yeah, they are.
And so somebody's getting a message about that kind of food isn't good for you. I guess it's fine to eat it once in a while. I'm not against that. The problem is that's not how those companies make their money. So whether you're staggering up to the fast food counter, crawling up, walking out of your car, skateboarding in, I don't know. But if you're there every day, that seems to me to be what the issue is.
In the spirit of Morgan Spurlock, we should say. We're talking
that's
Art
right.
Kaplan from NYU.
So, Art, let's move on to this story about women selling breast milk. The New York Times piece highlights this one woman who took an unpaid maternity leave 5 months ago. So far, she's made $2,000 by pumping breast milk and selling what's left over after she feeds her own kid. But this has become a big debate with lots of people thinking this is absolutely a terrible way to go, that women should not be selling breast milk for profit. What do you think?
Well, you know, part of me thinks Les Miserables. I mean, it's sort of like, really, we're going to be selling our breast milk and our hair and our nails and our kidney and, you know, and some market, free market types are going to say, hey, you know, it's up to you. You make your choice to that. The good news about breast milk is it's not like selling a kidney. It's replenishable, so to speak.
Yeah.
The bad news about markets is you give people an incentive to lie about their health. So that was an old problem with blood. We used to have blood sales in this country way back in the 60s, and we finally did away with them because the people who sold blood tended to be very unhealthy, often had hepatitis, and you got a really poor quality of blood. We had tons of infections. The day we said blood has to be donated as opposed to sold, I think the hepatitis C rate in the blood supply dropped to like from 40% to 0.5%.
Wow.
I mean, it just collapsed. So that's where the issue is, I think, for its safety, its quality. The image of, you know, I'm a sort of animal getting milked and selling it, I think is one that I think offends, but I could live with it because I don't think you're really hurting yourself. It's not like we have an ample supply of breast milk, by the way. We do need it. It's better than formula. But you got to be careful because you want to watch the quality of what comes out when you incentivize people. You're telling them, too, you know, hey, you're going to make this money. Don't admit that you're living a risky lifestyle or might have an infection or had a cold or whatever.
Why can't you test it?
Oh, you can, but the tests don't pick up everything.
Okay.
You can.
Okay.
I'm glad you're not wildly uncomfortable with the selling portion of it, if I'm characterizing your position well enough, because the companies are for-profit companies. And it seems to me is unsettling to some degree as the sale of the excess is. What's more unsettling to me is some corporation makes a ton of dough and the woman providing the product on which they're making the money gets nothing. I mean, there's something wrong with that picture, too.
Right. I believe that's called capitalism.
That is. I think it is.
I mean,
I knew there was a word for it. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, so it's classic. You know, I'm going to work real hard, did I see? Bonuses paid on Wall Street this year, or
yeah.
last time they paid them, were the equivalent of the entire sum of money earned by minimum wage workers in the
yeah.
United States.
It's outrageous.
Well, they're working hard on Wall Street, though. Come
well,
on,
speaking
Art.
Of work,
they are, I know.
Speaking of working hard, though, the image that upset me about the breast milk thing was, you think of these women that are selling this milk. I mean, they're pumping their breasts all
yeah.
day long.
Yeah.
Be absolutely
yeah.
exhausted.
There is some image here, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I am going to say it. There's an angle here of kind of dairy farming or something. It's sort of
yeah.
like, you know, you're going to pump and pump
yeah.
and pump, and we got to feed you right so you make good product, and then we don't want you to be sick. And that's what people mean when they say there's a commercialization or commodification angle that offends. It's not that it's hurtful to the woman, and the woman may make some money, and she's going to have excess milk anyway. It's not like people don't produce more, some women, than they can use, but you get that notion of turning your body into a kind of weird factor.
Yeah. No, it's a little odd. You're right. It's a little odd.
You know, Art Kaplan, a couple of weeks ago, we talked to you, maybe it was, I don't know when it was, recently we talked to you about one of the things that I am obsessed with, one of many, which is concussions in sports.
Mm.
And I'm ordinarily much more interested in concussions in kids as opposed to concussions in adult athletes because they make allegedly informed decisions or semi-informed
mm-hmm.
decisions. Well, I was going to say there's another nail in the coffin, a horrible choice of words. There's another piece of evidence. A study published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine says that position players, meaning non-pitchers in baseball, in the major leagues who sustain concussions don't hit as effectively in their first weeks back after they suffer a concussion. Now, no, it's not surprising to me, but at least mm-hmm. the hard data is there. Is there any place where you spend your time where we're about to see some major breakthrough in on the whole concussion front? Everything seems to me to be incremental. The National Football League passed what they're now, I think in the last couple of days, a new rule, the Julian Edelman rule, they're calling mm-hmm. it, named after the terrific receiver for the Patriots who took a hit that was surreal in the Super Bowl.
No, we all thought he was knocked silly.
Out of his mind. And then
out there.
And he comes
yeah.
back and he obviously makes a key catch and catches a critical touchdown
mm-hmm.
Pass. Allegedly, there'll be spotters on the field. I don't even know. Need to go into details of that.
I remember
but everything.
Chris Borland, the San Francisco linebacker, quit.
After 1 year.
Too dangerous. I don't have a concussion, but I don't want one. So I'm out of here.
And we told you, Chris Nowinski is a friend of ours from Sports yeah. Legacy Institute who works, a former pro wrestler, former Ivy League football player. But everything to me just seems to be incremental. Maybe that's all that we're ever going to get till we reach the critical moment. But is there any place in which we're about to see a serious breakthrough? I think you're the one that mentioned to us, and as has Chris, you know, a lot of people say there shouldn't be contact or tackle football till you're 12 or whatever.
Yeah.
Maybe the same.
Yeah.
Is anything major about to happen on this front? Because this is a huge crisis.
I don't see any big breakthroughs coming. Part of the problem is damage to the brain from concussive injury seems to be a cumulative process, and you get it in practice, and it sort of builds up over time. So even though we see those big hits like the Edelman hit or other, you know, sort of gigantic collisions at the pro level, if you've been playing tackle football since you were six, it's sort of, you know, you're banging, your head bangs inside your natural helmet, your skull, and you sort of build up damage. So I think there's no immediate short-term solution in sight for this, but I do think reducing the number of times your head gets knocked around is important. I would ban, absolutely prohibit tackle football for kids under high school age. Let them play tag or flag or
flag, yeah.
touch. And then, you know, reduce the number of contact hours in the pros, even in practice. You want to sort of cut back and not have those fans of the game, and I am one. I bitterly sometimes criticize myself for being one, but I am one. You know, you get out there for those two-a-days and summer practice, and they're smashing each other up. None of us see that, but that's
yeah.
not good for your head.
You know, by the way, when you said you're a fan, for the record, this is a Framingham kid we're talking to, and now a New York transplant. Tell us you still root for the Patriots, not the Jets or the Giants, Art Kaplan.
Oh, I don't root for the Jets or the Giants. I'm not. My brain isn't that damaged.
Okay. But so, one last thing on this.
You know, I'll make a confession.
Yeah.
I got to confess something. I
sure.
do root for the Patriots, but I am also a fan of the Eagles, because remember I lived in Philly a long time?
Yes,
oh, yes.
That's right.
Was so lost and so hopeless and so frustrated They needed fans when I actually got there.
Thanks for throwing me a bone as a Philly boy. I appreciate it. You know, before we leave the subject, though, we often ask you about what doctors and other medical professionals should be addressing when they're in that one-on-one setting with a patient. Should they be talking to parents of underage kids about the risk of contact sports, even if that's not the reason why the kid is seeing him or her? Is that something that should be on their checklist as well?
It is, and remember, just to have pity on the poor doc. So I think on this show we've now established they should talk about guns, they should talk about contact sports,
yep.
They should ask about wearing a condom, they need to get into the question of buckling your seatbelt.
Behavioral therapy,
are you suicidal? I think they get 5 minutes with each patient.
Yeah.
So part of the problem here is, yes, they should. But if we're going to really have a primary care world that we like and sort of do risk reduction there, you got to give them more time, and you probably have to pay for it. So that's where I see the biggest problem. They got a bunch of things they could talk to you about, and I think they should talk to you about. But we all know a lot of these places, you get 5-10 minutes with a doc, their head is in the computer trying to enter data on you, and there's not a lot of chit-chat going on.
We're talking with Art Kaplan, who's our medical ethicist. Art, I want to talk to you about this story that was on this website, Vox, which is a great website, by the way, kind of a big explainer kind of thing. And there was a piece on there talking about an exploration of 101 studies published in top scientific journals between 1979 and 1983 that claimed that a new therapy or medical technology was very promising. Everybody gets all excited, especially people that are suffering from those various diseases. Out of those 101, only 5, they found out, made it to market, and only 1 was still used extensively at the time of their publication. Basically, they were saying that these medical studies are mostly wrong.
Well, remember, it's also true of all the reports on coffee is good for you, coffee is bad for you. So we have that literature, you know, eat a lot of grapes, don't eat any grapes. Pardon me. So you have a situation, I think, where the bottom line is this. As much as the media and even press offices at NYU, where I am, for example, just beat up on my own school for a second, they'll like this. Every week we issue press releases. And you know what? There are probably 4 or 5 breakthroughs that come out of NYU Medical Center each week. And that's one place.
Wow.
So I feel privileged to live in a world of miracles. This is great. And we're making strides day by day to conquer everything. And then at the end of the year, still look at the same mortality statistics. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't as good. So there's a lot of reason that people hype stuff up. They want attention. They want donors. They want money. They want investors. They're trying to attract capital investment. That's part of the reason these early studies get heard. Simple comment for me, there are no breakthrough studies. There never are. There's only confirmation. And then you might say you got something that's a breakthrough. So single reports, they're interesting. I wouldn't change my lifestyle or invest money until I got more information beyond the initial hypey declaration.
So let's end with this. Give advice to people who do what Marjorie and I do for a living. How should we treat these 101 reports? I don't just mean those 101. When they come out and they're really exciting on their face, what caveats should we be issuing?
So I'd say something like, there's a report out from Art Kaplan that says strawberries, if you eat them, you live 5% longer.
Wow.
That's pretty interesting, and we hope that everybody studies that for a lot longer and confirms it. Wouldn't change my diet yet, but there's kind of an interesting idea out there that deserves more inquiry. And after all the listeners have turned off, you can. But I mean, that's the truth.
Yeah.
That is the problem.
Okay. Art Kaplan, co-host the Everyday Ethics Podcast. What is the Everyday Ethics Podcast today?
Going back, grimly, sadly, to the world of Alzheimer's, actually a new drug came out with a lot of promise. This, just on Friday, Cambridge company, Biogen, had some success with the drug, but, that's good, but part of the issue will be who's going to get access to it and when, because if you're facing Alzheimer's, I'll tell you, people are desperate. They will try anything. So how are we going to manage that demand before the drug really makes it to approval?
Let's put it on next week's list. That's a great topic. Art, thanks. We'll be looking forward to talking to you next week.
Hey, look forward to it.
Art Kaplan, thank you. As always, Art is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of, we just mentioned this, the Everyday Ethics podcast. And Art joins us every Wednesday. Coming up, we're going to ask you guys, are you a victim of hyped up health reporting? 1 month, are you pounding vitamin E for brain health? The next month, is it crossword puzzles? That's our question to you next on 89.7 WGBH. Before we get to that question next on WGBH, we want to tell you we are, needless to say, thrilled to spend 3 hours with you every weekday with limited interruptions, very short. We have some great underwriters, but most of the funding that keeps the lights on here and the transmitter working every day comes from your support, listener support. Today, this program is coming to you fundraiser-free thanks to listener support. But as they say, we're not out of the woods yet. Please give a gift in any amount right now, $5, $10, $20, whatever you can do before this program ends at 2 o'clock, and prove that less fundraising is a good way to go. Call 888-897-9424 or pitch in online at wgbhnews.org.